It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your host, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell and Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
For the right advice at the right time, call on the folks at Harvell and Collins. And Wes Collins is with us now. Cecil Harvell is coming in the studio as well. So good morning, Wes.
Good morning, Ben.
How you doing?
Doing great.
Cecil's going to join us too. But Wes, we were talking about a case last week we didn't finish. So.
Right. We were talking about a case, actually it was hurricane related, you know, when the hurricane had just come through a week and a half ago, obviously. Matthew kind of prompted my memory of this case, and it was about a elderly couple that basically fled Carteret County and went to Cumberland County because there was an evacuation, and unfortunately the husband was hit by a vehicle while he was there. He was crossing the road and was hit by a vehicle he's walking across to get dinner, basically. He was hit by a car and he was killed. And just to kind of give an update with regard to that, thumbnail sketch, and then we'll move forward. Basically, the situation with that case was that the police report in that case indicated that the cause of the accident wasn't as a result of the fault of the driver, but it was as a result of the individual who was walking across the street failing to yield, failing to look both ways, so on and so forth, and it was chalked up to his basically negligence. So, of course,
a tragic accident.
Right. Our office It was a tragic accident. Our office dealt with the administration of the estate, which we do, of course, a lot of estates. And then the litigation part of the case came into my part of the office. And, of course, we evaluated it. And the first knee-jerk reaction to it is this is going to be a tough case because the police report, police report indicating basically contributory negligence, which is something we talked about last week. North Carolina is one of the few states that is a contributory negligent state, so that in the event that the person's injured, let's say the person in this case who was hit by the vehicle was negligent in any way, then you can't recover at all. You know, even, for example, if maybe even the guy was speeding, that type of thing.
Right.
Okay. So it's a complete bar to recovery if you're just 1% negligent. Most states are comparative negligence, so the jury makes a determination as to what percentage goes on each side as it relates to the negligence, and then the damages are split, you know, in that way.
I think where we left it is that something had some red flags have been raised, and that you brought up with the widow at the time, right?
Well, yeah. Moving forward a little bit, obviously at that point in time, we had to make a decision about what we were going to do with the case because we contacted the insurance company. The insurance company denied any coverage on it. This is the driver's insurance. My recollection is there was a $250,000 limit on the policy, which was a good limit. That was a good thing, a high limit. And so we had conversation, of course, at that point in time with the spouse about whether we would proceed or not, because from all indications, it just seemed as though it would be a tough case because of the contributory negligence issue. But this was 5 or 6 years ago, and I could tell you at that point in time in my practice, I've been practicing, 11 or 12 years at that point in time. Now I've been practicing 17 years. I've certainly learned that you don't, it's not always as it appears. You don't always know all the facts. You don't feel like you should, you know all the facts until you file the lawsuit and done some discovery and see what's going on. And that happens every day of the week in cases. I'm surprised that I find things in discovery. Some things help my cases. Some things hurt my cases. You just don't know. But at any rate, after discussing, you know, the case with the spouse at that point in time, the decision was to at least file the lawsuit, proceed with some discovery, take some depositions, and see what we can determine about what in fact happened. We basically decided we weren't going to just rely upon what the investigative report from the police in Fayetteville revealed, but we wanted to look further into it.
Cecil, I think this is a good point to say that this is an important part of litigation, is that a lot of laymen probably don't really get, is that filing the lawsuit allows you to actually really look into this more deeply than
you can't emphasize that enough, Ben. That's a great point. You know, this is just it in a nutshell. You're out there kind of wondering what the documents might say. What do the medical records say? What do witnesses maybe have to offer? Just any number of kinds of information, mm-hmm. either documentation or statements or opinions,
mm-hmm.
Verbal and in writing. And we lawyers do not have access to this information
right.
until, bingo, the lawsuit is filed. Once a lawsuit is filed, there is then subpoena power. You can then subpoena these witnesses to sworn depositions. You can obtain the medical records. You can obtain any statements. You can obtain any kind of information. And that is, in fact, as we have sometimes, kind of gone through the steps of litigation. Mm-hmm. One of the key steps of any litigation file is what's known as the discovery process. When you are in, that is literally what it legally
right.
is called, discovery.
Right.
There are treatises, if you will, books on mm-hmm. discovery. And it's the discovery of information through subpoenas, through documentation, through sworn statements, etc. And of course, as Wes is now explaining, once that box gets opened,
mm-hmm.
you know, there many times are lots of surprises, okay, positive and negative, depending on, you know, who you're representing. But this is the wonder of the mm-hmm. law, in that, of course, obviously we're trying to obtain what's accurate and truthful, and this is the way we go about the process of doing it.
All right, Wes. Well, as Cecil said, the box is now open.
That's right. Yep. We file a lawsuit, but I do want to go back and say that, you know, this, I remember that this case was not just about a recovery for the family. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just about money. I remember sitting down with the spouse and talking with her about this situation. And, you know, keep in mind, she just lost her husband.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember her very vividly saying that, I don't think my husband would have walked out in front of a car. He's just not that kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know what happened. You know, for his honor, I want to know what happened.
Right.
I want to get down to the facts here. So that was that principal part of the case that was driving it. In addition to, you know, obviously it costs money to deal with these things.
Mm-hmm.
We did engage an accident reconstruction expert, and we did conduct multiple depositions. And again, we're going into this case, and it appears that it was going to be somewhat of a tough case, but we have to handle it just like we would mm-hmm. any other case. We're
right.
not going to go into it and say, well, right. there's no way we're going to win this one. I mean, you don't do that. You know?
There was an issue with witnesses too, right?
There was. And basically, after some written discovery and getting driver's records of the driver and seeing mm-hmm. he had a pretty splotchy record with regard to his driving history, we decided that it would be most efficient to depose one of the eyewitnesses that was on the police report.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first, but he wasn't really a direct eyewitness. He saw the driver maybe 20
right
seconds
after.
Before
oh, okay.
the incident, and saw how he was driving. But I didn't really know that until I took his deposition, because he really wasn't that willing to, he wasn't willing to talk with me. It wasn't that he was not that willing.
He
wouldn't return my call. Okay. So I subpoenaed right. him to a deposition.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know if he was going to be hostile or not, but took his deposition down in the Fayetteville area, and then took the driver's deposition in the Fayetteville area. So what we found was that by taking the witness's deposition, was that he was actually very friendly when mm-hmm. he got there. And I found that the reason that he didn't want to return my call is because he didn't want to be involved, because he didn't want to miss work. But my goodness, once he was there, he was like, well, I'm missing work anyway, so yep. what do you want to know?
Yeah.
So took his deposition, and his testimony was very strong. Mm-hmm. He indicated that this driver was weaving in and out of traffic. My recollection was that he estimated the driver was exceeding 55 miles per hour. Believe it was a 40 mile per hour zone.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 45, but certainly speeding. He indicated that, this driver was not, you know, staying in his lane of traffic.
Right.
The rest of the traffic was moving a little bit slowly. And instead of just being patient and letting staying behind the car in front of him,
mm-hmm.
he weaved in and out and in and
We've
out.
We've all seen those.
That's yeah. right. He said, I did not see him hit the man, mm-hmm. but I noticed him driving mm-hmm. crazy, erratically, and out of control, basically. So that was helpful testimony.
How did he happen to come forth as a witness?
He was on the incident report.
Okay.
He was on the report. His name was there. His phone number was there. His phone number was wrong. We had to track him down through basically a person search program that we use.
Right.
Found him and got to his girlfriend and then got, you know, it's just the process of tracking the guy down. We finally found him and got him subpoenaed and didn't know if he was going to show up or not, but he did. So then this was the surprise of all surprises in this case. Mm-hmm. We then take the deposition of the driver. And now when you go into the deposition of a driver in this type of situation, you think he is going to say, well, I was driving the speed limit. Mm-hmm. You're going to think that I was paying attention. You're going to think he's going to say, you know, I the guy walked out right in front of me, you know, those kind of things. But that's really not where this deposition went. This is what broke the case wide open. During the deposition, I noticed because of the discovery that I received that he had a restriction. Well, actually, prior to the deposition, that he had a restriction on his license.
Mm-hmm.
And the restriction was corrective lenses.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So as I was going through the deposition, as you often do in a deposition, you have multiple exhibits. You have them marked before the deposition takes place so you can hand one to the witness and one to the court reporter, and you stay very organized.
Mm-hmm.
So there were pages and pages of exhibits that we had prepared and I was going to be asking this gentleman about. And I acted as though, in this case, that I had a report of some sort indicating that he was not wearing his corrective lenses. But I didn't have such a report.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to see what he was going to say about that.
Right.
So I said, Mr. So-and-so, I see that you were not wearing your corrective lenses at the time of the incident. He said, that's right, I was wearing contact lenses.
Mm.
I said, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So you wear contacts. Yes. So then we proceed into 20 minutes of questions about where they were prescribed from,
mm-hmm.
who the doctor was, where he got them from, so on and so forth. Okay. Now, as far as I knew, he was wearing his glasses.
Right. Right.
But he admitted that he wasn't, mm-hmm. but he said he was wearing contact lenses because he thought that I had something indicating he did not have corrective lenses on. So long story short, I noticed the gentleman is starting to sweat.
Mm-hmm.
He's nervous.
All right. We're going to leave you hanging right there for a second and come back after this break because it is a fascinating case and how it comes to be. And it's a lesson to learn about a litigation. We'll talk about that coming up in a moment here on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law. Hey, welcome back with Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law, talking about litigation. And Wes, you left us hanging there.
Right.
We were talking about
taking the deposition of the driver who unfortunately hit a man who was walking across the street, and I represented the family who was of the man who died.
And in asking him questions about his vision,
yeah,
he started sweating.
Right. He started sweating because I started asking him questions about whether he had his corrective lenses on. He committed himself immediately to wearing contact lenses.
Mm-hmm.
I then asked him, I said 20 minutes, it could have been 30 minutes of questions about who his doctor was, where the doctor was located, what the doctor looked like, when did he get his prescription, when was the prescription filled, when's the last time he got his prescription, hard contacts, soft contacts, daily mm-hmm. contacts. I mean, I went on and on. I happened to be a contact lens wearer, so I had all the questions, you know. I've been wearing them since I was 11. So the guy didn't know the answers, mm-hmm. okay, and he was sweating bullets. Mm-hmm. So then, of course, we get to the point where I indicate that, well, so you can identify the doctor. He didn't know who the doctor was. I said, you can if you're given time. Is that right? Oh, yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And you can identify the doctor's office. So if I send a subpoena for those records mm-hmm. or I send a request to your attorney for those, no question, if you're given, you know, a little bit of time, you can provide those. Oh, yeah. So he committed himself to all mm-hmm. of these lies.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually at the end of this 20 or 30 minute attack on right. contact lenses,
right.
he stated, well, they weren't my contact lenses. They were my son's.
Mm.
Oh, okay. So you just left the house, decided, hey, I'm going to throw my son's contact lenses in my eyes and go for a drive. What was his prescription?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Where was his doctor? I'm not really sure. You know, he doesn't know any of this.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So I can just see the attorneys on the other side of the table just sinking in their chair because we've got all these lies.
Mm-hmm.
And now they know what has happened today. Number one, I have a witness saying he was driving erratically, crazy. He was in and out of cars. He was speeding, so on and so forth. I have a crazy driving record of this guy. I mean, just mm-hmm. a very bad driving record. And now I've got him lying about contact lenses, you know.
Not his prescription. He may not have been able to see anything.
That's right. Yeah. And not only that, not only was it not his prescription, he had no problem lying to me about it for 20 right. or 30 minutes.
Right.
So what do you think the jury is going to think about him?
Mm-hmm.
Probably not going to think too kindly of him. So
what
do you think happened with that case?
Well, my question is, how does that get rid of the contributory negligence? I mean, can you still prove the guy did not walk out?
Last clear chance, as we mentioned last week, that's mm-hmm. a defense to contributory negligence. And when we filed our answer, we filed our complaint, we brought last clear chance into the case.
Mm-hmm.
So that.
So, meaning that the driver had the last chance.
He had the last clear chance, okay, to avoid this. And we think that all of these are jury questions now, meaning the court is not going to grant summary judgment anywhere on any of this. And given the fact that this driver, this defendant, has lied so much under oath, and we have this other testimony that we've gathered through discovery that – you know, now everyone is evaluating this case differently, and the jury is certainly going to side with the family who lost their loved one
right.
and not with the individual who was driving erratically, who lied under oath and probably caused the accident, had nothing to do with the man who was killed walking out and maybe failing to yield.
You know, one of the important points there, Cecil, is that a lot of people may not think this through, is that depositions are under oath. You know, they are.
They absolutely are. Yeah. And, of course, we do hear a lot about that in all of our I hate to bring it up, but in all of our political arena this day and time about, you know, depositions, you know, all of the things that have been going on relative to people testifying under oath. And you absolutely, you know, are under swearing at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if there is then a falsehood said, that is a major problem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, you know, as a lawyer, which I am, but a non-litigation lawyer, my perspective to add to this conversation this morning is that, Ben, you know, it is absolutely true that North Carolina is one of only a handful of states, if not just one or two, that still recognize contributory negligence. Most states have gone to comparative negligence, and the jury just simply says, well, you know, you shouldn't have been going so fast. You're 80, 90% of the problem, but he shouldn't have stepped in front of your car either.
Right.
So you're 10 or 20% of the problem, and then we do damages from there. We are not one of those states, as Wes has very clearly said. But I think that it is kind of recognized with the litigation bar that if you can get beyond some of the preliminary motions for the case to be dismissed based on contributory negligence and get these issues before 12 people in a jury box, they kind of have a way of looking the other way on this law and kind of merging all of the facts and circumstances together, okay, and coming out with the result that we can't call comparative negligence, but many times kind of is. I mean, after all, jurors are people. They're living, breathing, you know, they have their own lives, and they look at these kinds of things from a practical perspective.
Okay, more to come in a moment from Harvell and Collins, and Let's Talk Legal. Hey, welcome back here on Coastal Daybreak, and Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. And so now the conclusion of this case.
All right, so you know, when you're sitting there taking the deposition and the guy just completely falls apart and lies under the oath like this, it's not normally defense attorneys, they're not going to just say, oh, well, let's settle the case now. You know, there's like a cooling off process and everybody's quiet and everybody kind of knows what just happened, you know, in the deposition. But then we set mediation probably a month later, something like that, mediated the case, actually mediated here in Carteret County at our office, Morehead City. And, you know, remember that this case started out with them offering zero.
Right.
Because of contributory negligence. Well, the, long story short, they ended up paying almost the full policy limit of $250,000.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly than that, the family, the daughter and the spouse, they got closure out of this.
Right.
They realized, you know, our father, our husband, he did not die as a result of some mistake he made.
Mm-hmm.
It was a tragic accident, a tragic event, but it really wasn't his fault. And that, I think that they felt a sense of peace with regard to that.
Mm-hmm.
The monetary part of it didn't hurt either, obviously, you know,
right.
a couple hundred thousand dollars or so. But again, this case would never have gotten to that point. We never would have had closure. We all would have assumed he did just walk out in front of a car. There would not have been a recovery from the insurance company at all if we did not take the risk of going through the process and getting the discovery and taking the depositions and kind of getting lucky a little bit about some questions about the glasses, corrective lenses, and the defendant kind of went down that path he shouldn't have gone down. But, you know, I was able to take advantage of that. And I think the truth then rose to the top at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
So
last but not least, Ben, and I know you all say you discussed this last week, but it's just an interesting place to end. Wes mentioned more than once the daughter.
Mm-hmm.
She was, of course, an adult daughter in her 50s. And, of course, isn't it interesting in the state of North Carolina, as you all mentioned last week, that wrongful death proceeds, which is what this is, they do not pass according to the will.
Right.
They pass according to intestate succession in the state of North Carolina, which usually, if you will, a general way of saying it, sprinkles these proceeds amongst all members of the family, not only the wife, but also the children and any children of a deceased child. So that's just an interesting way to conclude this story by reminding our listeners that in the state of North Carolina, if you do tragically have a loved one that is killed in an accident, proceeds or recovery at that point are distributed amongst the family. They do not pass according to the terms of the will.
And again, this was this a suit brought against the insurance company?
No, you bring it against the defendant. There was a risk there that in the event we tried the case, we could have gotten a judgment for $500,000, and then that's called an excess verdict.
Right.
That means he only has $250,000 worth of coverage.
Right.
So we could have gotten a verdict for more than that and then tried to collect assets from him. We did the research and found that he was really didn't have much as far as assets. So really the $250,000 is what we were looking at. Yeah, that was basically it.
Okay, again, all part of that research. Again, if you want to find out more, you want to call on the folks at Harvell & Collins, Attorneys at Law, and give them a call at 726-9050-1107 Bridges Street in Morehead City.